called Three Words, Christian Faith in the Nuclear Arms Race. Yesterday we looked at Christ and sin, and today Easter. So we're ready for a few carryovers from yesterday. It was interesting to sense the mood yesterday when we were finished. It was obvious we needed another session. And what I'd like to share today is not to move you to kind of an optimism where we would say, well, it's not so bad after all. Things are looking up. You know, that wouldn't be a realistic. One of the staff people told me this morning that just last night one of the children here in the village had a dream and woke up this morning thinking in this dream that the nuclear Holocaust was going to be Monday, you know, and was actually woke up planning what kind of candy bars to get, and then wondering where the bomb shelter here was at Holden. I think this shows how real what we're talking about is to children. So the purpose will not be to move us to some form of optimism that it's really not that bad, but to really move us to the joyful area of what we call Christian hope. And I think the only people, in a way, or maybe some of the only people that are really going to make it through the years ahead without going into despair are the ones that cling on to what we call Christian hope. But a few things from yesterday. I wanted to make one differentiation between military and militarism. And we mentioned from a Lutheran standpoint, a military would be a legitimate government service to the people of that nation. Militarism is when any order such as this becomes what we call idolatrous, where it begins to assume the position of God and ask and demand for total obedience and promise ultimate, in a way, security. Then any institution has a danger of moving from service to idolatry. And this is helpful, especially in talking to people who've had military backgrounds or been involved in the military, that what we're asking is the examination of an order, and we're not saying everyone who is in the military is evil. I mean, sometimes people that are in the so-called peace movement make everybody that's anyway connected with the military feel bad. Do you know what I mean by that? But we're examining a system and asking if a system has gone out of control. And what's very interesting is that at the time of the Reformation, Martin Luther was a monk who dared to examine the system in which he was involved, the church. And in a way, the church at that time was edging very close to what we might call idolatrous as an institution. One person I know who studied the Reformation quite extensively, the church had come not to serve the people, but the people existed to serve the church. And today is what's called, if you're a Roman Catholic, today is called a holy day of obligation. Are you familiar with that? Which simply means today it's a day when a Roman Catholic is expected to go to Mass on a day of obligation. In old times, on a day of obligation, you could not work. And the church at the time of Luther had made so many days of obligation that the farmers didn't even have time to put their crops in or harvest their crops. You know, it had become ridiculous where you were living for the church rather than the church being a body of people that live to serve. You know, and our very Reformation is because one monk risked to challenge an institution that had gone out of control. And it's a question I was raising yesterday. Are we dealing with an idea that has used the military and has gone out of control in our world? And I'd like to just try to answer this question the way I've answered in my own mind. How do systems go out of control? And I think they go out of control, the kind of the soil that provides the nourishment, you might say, for a system to go out of control, I think would be maybe two, fear and hate. And maybe especially fear. And think of the times the Gospels say, fear not. You know, read the Gospel sometime and just read how many times the angels say to the shepherds, do not be afraid. The angel at the tomb, do not be afraid. Jesus to the disciples, the storm, you know, don't be afraid, fear not. Just some examples how Nazi Germany, the government, went out of control. And think of the fears that were kind of the fears of people that were made this happen. The fear of economic collapse, the fear of communism, and then the hatred of Jews and the hatred of the victors of World War I. You know, you get all of this mixed together and the system goes out of control. And then the third word is lies. The system, as it's going out of control, promises fearful people that this system has the answers to your problems of fear. In other words, the system itself says, I will give you security. Jim Jones and the People's Temple, that went out of control because people were so afraid of the world and had a certain hatred of the world and a fear of their lives in the future, and then gave themselves to a person who promised, and it was really finally a lie, wasn't it? Promised that I will keep you and I will protect you and I will give you security. If the arms race, and I'm talking about the worldwide arms race, is a system that has gone out of control. Have you read the author Kurt Vonnegut? He writes delightful novels. But he gave a speech recently where he really compared the arms race to being drunk. And he says, not drunk with war, but drunk with the preparation for war. You know, and that's the way he said it. Well, I just listed some of the possible ways this has happened. And some of you who have lived through some more of this than I have maybe can fill some things in. The United States came out of the Second World War with a tremendous fear of depression. You know, the depression happening again. And I think you can pinpoint decisions were made that after the war we would continue a wartime economy. In other words, the wartime industries would continue, and then that would keep us from going back into a depression. Plus the tremendous fear of another Pearl Harbor. You know, we were caught off guard, and I think we came out of the war with a sense, never, never will this ever happen again. So we came out of the war with that fear, plus the decision to keep our economy going. I mean, this may be oversimplified, but it's some of the things I try to put together in my mind. And then USSR... came out of the Second World War with a history of devastating attack. If you would read the history of the vulnerability of the Russian people over the years, Napoleon, and then the Hitler invasions into Germany, or into Russia, 20 million of their people killed during the Second World War. That they came out of the war with a tremendous sense is never again are we going to let our borders be invaded so we will lose 20 million people again. Now, I see it as happening this way. Then our continuing of a military industry after the Second World War was interpreted by them as hostile. So then they continue a military buildup. And then we see that as a communist threat. So then we continue the buildup And then they see that as a hostility towards them, and then in all of their insecurity about again being invaded. And you see how just the cycle just goes on and on and on again. And, you know, and there are many other, this is complicated, I'm oversimplifying. You're also dealing with the nations that both the United States and the Soviet Union in different ways have a sense of worldwide destiny. And each sees the other's vision of a worldwide destiny as a threat to its. So, I mean, all of these conditions went together, and as I said, in my perception, somehow the thing just went out of control and now has spread to almost every nation on Earth. You know, and now a nation like Costa Rica, who has decided not to have a military establishment, is under tremendous pressure now because they're kind of out of line with the rest of the world. Here's a thought I had. Hitler lost World War II, but in a way he won. And Hitler's propaganda supervisor said when they were losing the war, he says, we'll really win because our ideas will prevail. His basic belief that brute force is the way to live politically in the world has been embraced with enthusiasm by almost every government on Earth. And one writer, Ruth Severd, who is a sociologist who compiles thousands of statistics on world militarism, says, for developing countries, sophisticated weapons, professional soldiers, and a fledgling arms industry have come to represent the symbols of nationhood. And now, don't worry, this is only going to be 5 more minutes. You're probably saying, I thought he was going to give us some hope. But I wanted to set this up as the darkness, I think, into which we can move with the question of Christian hope. Today, over $600 billion a year is used for military. That's total military expenditures. And that's an incomprehensible figure. Our projections for the United States for the next 5 years are it's anything between 1.5 to 2 trillion. Others who have read statistics, am I close? When you think of that in comparison to a world where 1 billion people live in poverty, 500 million are malnourished, and then over 500 million are either underemployed or unemployed. And then you add to that the fact that when we talk about warfare and talk about nuclear warfare, we're talking about a qualitative different form of warfare. You know, in a way, we've discovered the secret of the sun and brought that to the earth, and that is now in the hands of humanity whom, as Christians, we define as sinful. And if you've read Mark's gospel this week, one thing Mark's gospel does say is people are stupid, right? You know, and now those people that Mark defines as basically not seeing have in their very hands the very power of the universe to unleash. Well, now what... like I said, if you're feeling a little sense of despair, it is a feeling I get the more I study this, and there are a few hopeful things you read. There are some, but let's move from that into what we would call now Christian hope. What we mean by Luther used this term, the theology of the cross. He defined the theology of the cross at an argument he had within his order of monks, and it was called the Heidelberg Disputation. And the Reformation was getting heated by this time, so the supervisor of the order asked him to come and present something of a non-controversial nature. So he came and presented the theology of the cross. And I think he probably had a smile when he knew what they had asked him to do. And basically what he proclaimed at that disputation is this, that God meets us at our point of suffering and weakness and darkness. That is where we find God. And he said this in the context of a church that said we meet God by climbing the ladder to some glory, even the glory, either glory of a religious experience or the glory of reason, that somehow you climb and there meet God, but Luther says that it's in the very darkness and the bleakest point of human existence that God meets us, and that's what he defined as the theology of the cross. And if we are going to carry that into our situation today, it's when we get into the darkest words about human existence today, which, among other things, of course, but includes the worldwide arms race of the world rushing towards devastation, then we have to say that it is not by leaving this that we go off into some marvelous religious experience to find God, but it is right here that God meets us in Jesus Christ. And the final vision of the theology of the cross is Jesus dying on the cross, is God meeting the human race, not at the point of its greatest glory, but at the point of its deepest despair and pain on the cross. And it's at this point there's only one way to come into this is almost as mystical. And that is, as I encounter the very darkness of the worldwide arms race, it's there that the crucified Jesus meets me. And I listen to the crucified Jesus. And the words that Jesus says are not new, only the situation is new. It's, I love you and I forgive you. I accept you and I forgive you. And I will be with you always. I will always be with you wherever you are. And then the healing ministry of Jesus and Jesus' forgiveness in that darkness is to just say to me, come out and turn your direction to a new way. But then here's the most profound word that I hear of the crucified Jesus that meets us in this darkness. My mind just went completely blank.
Darkness.
Really did. Oh, okay, it came back. Here's the vision I see, is that this word comes to me that's a very freeing word. And it's this, Dan, you do not have to solve this problem. You know, the load is taken off of my shoulders, and in my kind of sense of prayer or mystery, the crucified Jesus says to me, I am working to end the arms race. You don't have to do it. You know, and that's interesting that we as Lutheran Christians always say God does everything for our personal salvation. You know, if you've learned anything from your Lutheran pulpit, it's at least this, that we do nothing for our salvation. And this word now comes, we finally do nothing to solve this problem, but, you know, sometimes I stop here and everybody says, oh no, he's just calling us to Lutheran quietism. God wants my offering that God will use as one little part of God's work to stop the arms race. And this is exactly where I said we can have parties. You know, we can stop and have hilarious moments of laughter. And I've told this to congregational peace action groups. I said, have parties. You know, and when you walk in the door of your party, give the arms race back to God, and God will hold it for 3 hours while you just laugh and have a good time. Are you hearing me?
Yes.
Okay. And then God calls me to give my gifts. And then the other thing I see. But before I want to go backwards in history to what I think is a tremendous sign of hope. That at one time, about 150 years ago, give or take some years, there was a systemic, is that how you say the word? Systemic. I was like to say that once. At least. There was an out-of-control establishment or order that had gone out of control and had the world in its clutches and was a demonic evil that of such gigantic proportions that no one could ever say, oh, this is going to end slavery. A worldwide economic system based on the stealing of human beings from their communities and turning them into prisoners to work for that system. And if you would have lived in the South like about the year 1800, 1820, the system of slavery would be so entrenched there was no way you would have seen that it was going to end. But then in spite of that, and by the way, it was just as controversial in the churches as the arms race is today. Remember I started there, pastors would not bring up the subject of slavery, it would upset people. Pastors, and probably including myself, would have been afraid to say anything about slavery because too many people were involved in the economic benefits of slavery. You know, and when you look back now, you give tremendous credit to the few people who, in the churches, who took a stand, and you especially admire some churches like the Quakers and the Mennonites and others who took stands at that time against slavery. The early abolitionists that worked against slavery, it was so overpowering. They certainly didn't do it because they thought they were going to win in the next year. Their one concern, as I read about them, was to be faithful to God. And a sense that God will turn this around. In Britain, God turned this around without war. In the United States, part of it was the suffering of a civil war, an example of how human beings bring upon themselves the suffering of their sin. But basically or virtually, God did end slavery on this planet. And now our fervent prayer is that soon God would do the same with torture. Read sometime about how many nations on this earth use torture as a regular government policy, and I mean both communist nations and dictatorships of the capitalist world. Pray that God will call us to do a part. And then the arms race. You know, again, someday I think the church will look back and said, my goodness, that was controversial in the church. I hope that day will come. You mean actually they used to argue in the churches whether or not they should stockpile nuclear weapons? They argued about that? You know, just like today we'd say, you mean some Christians thought slavery was okay? You know, this is, again, my perception as I see it, or my dream of what might happen in a hopeful future. Okay, that's a sign of hope. Now, once once I have turned the arms race over to God, and just to repeat again, I'm not talking quietism. I'm talking now about a God who, in the darkness, Jesus calls me to turn and in my own way contribute to peace on earth using the gifts that I have. And God will take my little offering and join it with the offerings of hundreds and thousands and millions of other people. And God will turn this around. If, and I always have to say if, we don't blow up the world. And my hope would even say that if we do, God will spend maybe a million years weeping, and then God will begin to clean up this little planet that God loves. You know, and if families that have a big family, many children, there's always that one little kid that hurts the most and is always in the most trouble, so you give that kid a little more. And I always think when God looks at all the planets and galaxies and solar systems, he looks at Earth and says, what a mess. That place needs extra love. That God will finally clean it up and bring the whole process of life back and says, I will not back down on my promise to this little planet that it will reach shalom, that it will reach the day of peace. But I think God needs us to help, that God doesn't have to spend the millions of years to clean it up, to start it over again. Now I want to just close some reflections with Easter and then invite you to share your, especially words of hope and words of encouragement, because one danger of people who are concerned about peace is to get together and spend a whole evening talking about how bad everything is. You know, and all you have to do is bring a newspaper and a Time and a Newsweek and a few other magazines and you can get all kinds of things. You know, and we need to face those honestly, but let's now look at words of hope. We just celebrated Easter. We're still in the Easter season. And I want to just think about the meaning of Easter now for a minute in relation to the arms race and worldwide militarism. In the one hymn of Easter, we sing, the powers of death have done their worst. How's the next line go? I forgot. Does someone want to grab an LBW? It's too good not to.
The dying word is dispersed.
Yeah. Somebody want to pass an LBW up? This hymn, I think, is... sometimes I think it's the best hymn. I'll have to... Sometimes I think it's the best hymn to sing as the first hymn of Easter. The battle is o'er, the battle done, now is the victor's triumph won, now the song of praise begun. The powers of death have, when I read these words, think of the Russian SS-20 or the MX or the Trident, you know, all these powers of death. The powers of death have done their worst, but Christ their legions has dispersed. Let shouts of holy joy outburst, alleluia. The three sad days have quickly sped. He rises glorious from the dead. All glory to our risen head, alleluia. He broke the age-bound chains of hell. The bars from heaven high portals fell. Let hymns of praise his triumph tell, alleluia. Remember the disciples on the road to Emmaus, and they said, we had hoped. Remember those three words? The most despairing words that a human could ever say. Have you ever reached that point of bleakness where you finally just said, I had hoped? They said, we had hoped that he would be the one. And I wonder if at least part of the disciples' feeling between Good Friday and Easter was this. He taught the way of the kingdom. He taught the way of love. He taught the way of turning the other cheek. He taught the way of going the second mile. He taught the way of conquering enemies with forgiveness. And the crucifixion is the evidence of both humanity and God that he was wrong. He was wrong. And they had the religious equipment to believe this because crucifixion was the curse of God. God had spoken and God had said wrong. And what is left in the world except the brute force of the Roman Empire? And there you had the most powerful military establishment up to that time in the history of the world. And what was left before Easter except this? That is the only power. That is the only power in the world. We had hoped that maybe there was another power, but we were wrong. Then Easter. Easter happened. And if Easter is many other things, it is at least this, is God saying, wrong. The conclusions you had reached between Good Friday and Easter, wrong. All of the powers, all of the out of control, all of the demonic powers, all of the principalities, everything that would captivate human beings, all idolatries have been defeated. And Jesus reigns forever and ever. And the final victory in this world will be the victory of suffering love. And why else were the disciples, other than having Jesus back, of course, the joy of Easter was the powers that defeated Jesus have now been defeated. And we know how history will end. And this happened once, or this sense happened once here at Holden. John Nelson, some of you know John Nelson, the campus pastor, who, by the way, is controversial, but has spent, I think, most of his life resisting the arms race. And he was up here at Holden one, I think this was 4 years ago, and I noticed him always walking around smiling, laughing, joking. We had the Eucharist. He went up to communion with that very un-Lutheran look on his face called a smile. You know, it's okay to smile at the Eucharist. He was smiling from ear to ear at the Eucharist. And I decided after the Eucharist to go and ask him a question to maybe, I was just curious. I walked up to him and I said, John, you have been working most of the last 20 years to stop the arms race. And it's worse now than when you started. Why are you always smiling? And he then smiled all the more and he whispered in my ear. And he said, I know how the story ends. I know how the story ends. Now, Mark's gospel calls us to see. And once you see the risen Jesus, then you begin to see the risen Jesus popping out all over the world. And you don't go to the newspapers. I mean, of course, we still read the newspapers. You don't go to the newspapers, but once in a while you see it in the newspapers. It's all over the world you see little signs of the risen Christ planting hope. And I believe that all of those little signs of hope will someday converge. And the powers that benefit from the arms race all over the world will be stopped. And then if you're too glorious now, then I'll say, then we'll have another big problem to deal with. God has a way of never ending the problems until the second coming or the final shalom, for which we joyfully hope. But in the meantime, when this one is turned around by God, then we'll have another wonderful opportunity to practice faith and hope. Well, that's just a little statement I have on why we can see the depths of the evil of worldwide nuclear and conventional war buildup, and at the same time have Eucharistic celebrations and parties. Okay. I'll stop there and just invite what you see as signs of hope, or just any kind of reflections you want to respond to what we've talked about in our sessions. So.
Well, I'd like to know, now your peace groups are working here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Are you doing anything, any kind of work in Russia?
Okay, that's...
Because I think it has to be done in both places mm-hmm. if we're going to do it.
Yeah, it's a very, it's a question that I think is valid, and it's asked a lot, is, you know, what good does it do to have a peace movement in the West if there is not a peace movement in the East? You know, then what do? Stop all of our arms and they just keep theirs. Are you familiar with, or have you asked this question yourself? Or you?
Everybody does. Your lot.
How would you respond to it?
Russians were claiming that, you know, we're doing all of this buildup and we're really the ones that are escalating and trying to bring about, you know, total war, military, whatever. It's all our fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're a...
That's natural for them to blame it on us.
If you're a parent and have at least two kids, you don't have too much trouble understanding the United States and the Soviet Union. Each is innocent.
Yeah.
And each sees the other totally at fault. Now, I never did that as a child, and I never do it as an adult. No, I'm just kidding.
So yeah. My adage, I can't change you, but I can change me.
And you could almost go on, the only possibility of changing the other is when I change, and then that person responds to my change. The matins this morning were about risk, you know, and that's maybe what we are talking about. Go ahead, Sharon.
The circle is a perfect example. Now, someone has to be the first one to stop the cycle of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And someone has to make a first step, has to be risky about it.
Yeah.
Sometimes in kids, argument is a game or a form of entertainment, and it's fun to argue if you get a reaction. If you don't get a reaction, it's lost its impact.
Yeah, then it's no fun at all.
Another thing that hit me as you were saying this, or you were saying that, is somebody told me once that in any family situation, when you say children say, "I had nothing to do to start this," they may honestly believe that. And there are as many truths in any situation as there are people involved in how they see it. And if they really feel that way, then for them it is true, whether in the overall situation or not. It's true as a whole. It's true to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
there's a tape in the tape library, and I forgot the speaker, but feels he's pinpointed the exact moment when the nuclear arms race started. It's an interesting thing. And it was at a meeting where both the United States and the Soviet Union were together right after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the statement by the United States is, "We have this power as a warning to you." And then one of the Soviet people actually told another Soviet delegate, "We must get to work." And almost like that, you know, if you worry about that, like sometimes kids need to finally figure out where it started. You know, it was an interesting one.
Yeah. There was an article in the Lutheran this past one on the Christianity, the exchange of Christianity with the Russian churches. And I think that's a good place to start. a lot of it is just, I mean, what you dealt with was fear. And I think a lot of this arms race is just plain fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, any way to break down or to establish personal...
We have to have people-to-people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have some underground Christianity going on in Russia. Because we send money to them.
Or I guess I would expand that to say that most of Christianity in Russia is above ground, you know, is Lutheran, Baptist, and Russian Orthodox churches that meet openly. And they meet, I mean, they're very restrained in what they can do, but they do meet openly.
Well, they, you know, they have these articles about how they smuggle the Bibles mm-hmm. in there to the people. So, okay.
There's more, I've read there's more people in the Soviet Union in church on Sunday morning than in all of Europe.
I can
see that. You know, so, or it's some statistic. Don't quote me on that. I'm just
The thing that concerns me is that I think at least the Christian community in the United States would be very willing to lay down arms, or many people would. But I'm not sure that that solves any problem, because our government with the Constitution is set up on the basis of defending the people. The government is not Christian, never will be, and never should be. And therefore, the only way that quote, our government knows how to provide security, which it's obligated to do in the Constitution, is with force. And, you know, I think that's, you know, I think we've solved one problem. The people are willing to lay down arms. There are many people are. But unless we change the Constitution of the United States, I don't know that the U.S. government would ever lay down arms, because it's obligated to defend its people.
It'd be fun to think, if we did lay down arms, let's say the United States did lay down arms, what do you think could happen?
Well, you can speculate on that, but I don't know that under the present circumstances it could ever happen, because of the way that the Constitution of the United States is established. And every government of the world, in a sense, is established somewhat the same way, that it's
right.
One of its purposes is to defend its people.
Yeah, then I would take that, okay, say that one of the purposes of the government is to defend its people, and that's what we talked about, is what in traditional Lutheran definition would be a legitimate government service. Then we have to ask the question, I have a clipping here from a newspaper of a Pentagon report of the possibility of winning extended nuclear war over a 6-month period, and actually the funding for the actual communication systems that will last. I mean, and that's when to become very frightened, when our government starts building the communication systems that would be used during a nuclear war. That means we're starting to think maybe we could win. The estimate of the Pentagon in this possible winnable nuclear war is only the loss of 20 million American lives. Then you have to ask, is the institution that we have asked to protect us doing its job? Do you understand my reasoning? And then the presence of nuclear warfare is really raising the whole question that needs to be raised. And as Christians, we have the best equipment to help our government with this. And just to help you understand it, I'll transfer it to a whole different part of the world. We were in Israel and visiting a friend of mine who was a Lutheran pastor in Jerusalem, at the American or the English-speaking church in Jerusalem, very deeply involved in the tense situation between Jews and Arabs, and very helpful in understanding the Palestinian-Arab point of view, because there's Lutheran congregations of Palestinian Arabs. And he said the only hope of Israel ever being secure in that part of the country is finally some way developing human relationships with the Arabs and the other nations around them. Finally, that is the only hope of security. Okay, transfer that back. Especially with the possibility of nuclear warfare where no one wins and everyone loses, and therefore the very, if the constitutional government service to protect the people is no longer there, then we have to start asking, do we need to seek other ways of security? And finally, you know that in your neighborhood, that if you are at odds with the next door neighbors, and if you each have guns and you're getting madder and madder, that getting more guns isn't going to make you more secure against your neighbors. The only final hope of security is to become friends.
Right.
And we need to ask this question because friendship with the Soviet Union is at its lowest ebb, I think, at least since the Cuban Missile Crisis. What equipment do we have as Christians to help our government reach out in ways that will establish true security with this, what we call an adversary nation? And I don't see, at least on the realm of international politics, any other possibility. Okay, the second thing to that is that finally when we gather as Christians, we do talk about what our nation should do. But our first question is, what should Christians do? You know, what does the Church of Jesus Christ do? You know, and one of the answers was to establish relationships with Christians in, quote, enemy countries. Then one other thing I wanted to respond to is the pressure democracies can put on their governments over against the pressures that people in communist countries cannot put on their government. Okay, that, we still haven't gotten to that question. Respond. I'll say this and then see, respond to it. It was in last September, Karen and I were in China and did a lot of studying of the history of China. And it was very interesting to us, in spite of the fact that it's a dictatorship, how sensitive the leaders of that country are to what the people are thinking. Do you know what I mean? That it's... and I think it's also true, maybe less so in the Soviet Union, that's just a guess, but there is a sense of response. And there is a mood in these countries of wanting peace. There is that mood. There also is dissent. Now, we know that from our East German Lutheran friends, that the Lutheran Church in East Germany has been part of a movement of dissent. And but finally, so I mean, there is that on both sides. Then you look at it, the other side is in the democracies, how responsive are our governments? I mean, the European people seem to have proof that the majority of European people didn't want the cruise missile or the Pershing. You know, the majority of the people did not want it. These are democracies. The governments still brought it. You know, then you start to ask, well, how, you know, is the world neatly divided between the governments that are totally responsive to their people and the governments who are totally unresponsive? The danger, I'll drop that and then finally just say this word of faith, that I cannot wait to do what I think is right for me until I see enough Russian people doing the same. Just like the early abolitionists, I have to do what is faithful to Jesus Christ. And then in a way, it's another act of trust. I leave the world in the hands of God and just pray, God, you take care of the outcome. It's what Martin Luther really meant when he said, sin boldly, I think.
But I think, I really think that of all the churches, you see, the churches are very, you don't have a legislative committee in church. But I really think if all the churches got together and wanted to get something passed in Congress, we're a lot of people, and we wrote to our senators and representatives, they would pass it because we would be enough, they would have enough letters. And I know it works because I've been on things that we've pushed and had everybody write letters. And too, and have gotten past both in state and national. And I know it works, and if churches would probably do that, they'd probably make more of an impression on it.
I think it's a sign of hope. I think the powers that need the arms race to keep going are afraid of the churches today. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful sign of...
I wouldn't bet on the outcome if there was a vote of a lot of people in the
church. I would bet on it.
Because I think that the majority of the people in the church would not vote for disarmament.
Well, I'm not talking about disarmament. I'm just talking about if the churches really wanted to do something and get it passed in Congress, they could. I'm not talking about disarmament or whatever. I'm talking about our government is responsive to us if we...
That's the problem. That I think in the Christian church, now in the Lutheran church, there may be a higher percentage than some others, but still in the Christian church, that you probably would not get the majority of people voting for disarmament.
I think that we have to make our own government, not just some government over on the other side of the world, but our own government to be responsible. They will not be responsible by themselves. You know, just statements that came out recently that says Congress should not disagree with the policy of the administration in a public forum. That tells me again the deepness of human sin and that we have to make people be responsible. People have the right to be responsible. And we need to ensure people that they have that right to be responsible. But I just don't think that it happens automatically in our country, that people are automatically responsible. One thing I learned from my grandmother, she said people are not automatically responsible. And people with power are less automatically responsible.
Grandmother.
More power they have, the less automatically responsible they are.
Your grandmother must have been a good theologian.
She was.
Most people are looking to be comfortable. They're looking to be. Unless they reach comfort, they don't worry too much about being responsible.
Aren't there really two issues? One, disarmament, and one, stopping the escalation of the arms race. Now, I think those are two different issues, and I think they get mixed together. Somebody can be against the escalation, but not necessarily unilateral disarmament completely.
I'd like to respond to another statement when you said that essentially Hitler won. Essentially he was also defeated. I mean, until you stomp, I think it's really important to hang on to and go back to the cross and all that, because you can be in the most dire situation there is, or in the middle of a nuclear war or whatever, and really physically or whatever, it is painful, it is very defeating, but you can never lose that realm of hope within yourself. And until you've taken that away from every individual person, you've not been defeated, and there's no way you can do it.
Mm-hmm. No. When I mentioned, you'd need to preface that in a way Hitler won.
I realize that, but I just think it's really important to verbally and consciously think about that. No, we have not lost our realm of hope.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, and I think I can, I have a feeling of myself back many years, and Nancy Reagan lived in a suburb, neighboring suburb to where we lived, and her father was... there was news about him all the time, and he was a very fervent right and of Birch Society person. And so when Nancy and Ronald Reagan got married, there was always this news about how Ronald was accepting Dr. Davis's theories and things and being absorbed by them. And actually, I had fear. When he first started running for president, I said, I'll move to Australia, because he's going to go against those communists. He's going to be so fervent because of this inbred thing. And finally, of course, they took away the fear, but...
It's a scary thing. I mean, some people perceive that Reagan maybe really hates communists, you know, and that's scary when you think...
When you go
I don't know. I don't know.
You go as guest to a country and then put down their government all the while there.
I guess I'd have to say the Russian communists. Yes. Yeah. What are some other signs of hope that you see around you and around the world? Let's just share some.
The flowers bloom in spring.
The sun comes up in the morning.
In spite of the snow.
Not in Antarctica.
The changes in drunken driving.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You mean that whole evil of concern about, you know, it's a sign of hope that things can change, right?
And that's because people put pressure on the governments.
Mm-hmm. Enough people get mad.
Yeah.
If we get rid of the word coincidence,
mm-hmm.
too many times things in our lives happen and we can say, gee, that's coincidental.
Mm-hmm.
And you might think maybe that really was God at work.
Yeah. To start seeing signs of God's presence.
Sure.
And, you know.
I have talked to Sharon during 1974, I worked with a cadre of Russian people who were bringing an exhibit to the 1974 World's Fair.
And
after. During 1974, I was. Part of my architectural responsibilities on the World's Fair, I managed part of the negotiations with the Russian people who were bringing an exhibit to Expo. And after a day of communicating back and forth, they were about to leave to return to Russia. And the group of us stood up, moved away from the table, and as they started to leave, we looked at one another, and there was a long, kind of uncomfortable silence. And what we were feeling was that we wanted to hug each other, but not knowing whether or not it was appropriate, that we didn't want to offend the protocol of the Russian people, and I think that they felt the same way toward us, and they disappeared. And the feeling that I have developed in this regard since then is that we seem to want to approach the situation of peace and disarmament from a standpoint of sort of self-righteousness, that we're very cautious when it comes to venturing out with vulnerability. And we want to sort of assure ourselves with reason that everything is going to be okay. And I think that holds us back a lot.
I thought last night's service was Vespers. Was a hopeful sign, the people that led it, and the way she did.
Story reminded me, I was speaking at a congregation on the Oregon coast, and one of the women in the congregation would, whenever a Russian ship came into port, she would take coffee cake down and serve it to the Russian merchant marine. She saw this as her little part, you know, and it really came to me as a vision of how God will take her offering, you know, add it with yours, bring in mine, bring in millions of other people. And when I see just here at Holden over the last years, there's so much more concern about peace on earth now than there was several years ago. I see every human being that cares as a sign of hope. And the powers that need this somehow to keep going don't know what they have ahead of them in people that God calls together. And I think one of the most exciting things, and I just pray I'll live another 20 years So I think God, I really think God is going to do something in about 20 years. Don't quote me on this either. But it's going to be exciting to see how God pulls all of us together.
Is that because of the turn of the century that you're thinking 20 years, or why so long?
Oh, I just picked it out of there.
I see.
Well, one reason is that when Ron Sider was here, he said that this system is so entrenched. You know, it is so. Even if we elected an administration that was totally committed to turning around the arms race, there's something about it that is so entrenched that it would. So Ron told us, if you're going to work for peace and the end of the arms race, he did say, think of 20 years. And he said, only people that have, I don't know exactly how he said it, but if you want to survive without going into despair, it's going to take a life of prayer. Your roots have to be in God, and trusting in God rather than in my ability in the next year. You know, and it's one reason, notice even the nuclear freeze movement, there's a sense of, oh, it didn't work. You know, there's not as much enthusiasm now for the freeze. I think there was a certain mood that, my goodness, we're going to turn this around next year. And
I wonder if, looking for a sign of hope, one of my biggest despair has been with the moral majority type of thing. That to me, when Christianity, any religion goes bad, that's not to be self-righteous either. But that possibly there's some sign of turn there, that they are not always winning, and that mm-hmm. we got to get the church turned around first.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the statistics about the government saying that they would hope to live at the deaths of 20 million. Well, you know, I mean, in working with statistics, that isn't too bad. I mean, you think that that's only 10% of the population that would be annihilated. But what about the church? You know, the church out in the Northwest is dealing with an unchurched population of, what, 85%? And, you know, that's been that way for years. And yet, no change seems to be there either. So I think they're, you know, if you want to criticize statistics, you know, the church is ripe for criticism on what they're supposed to be about.
I would say the Pentagon figure of 20 million is way low.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. But, I mean, just dealing with statistics, it's a very, you know, it's a very difficult thing. Mm-hmm. Because 10% isn't, you know, considered a bad, or 90% isn't considered a bad survival rate, you know, even 80%.
I think it's foolish to think of survival.
That's right.
I do too. Yeah. I think there's no more.
If they are planning on survival of a nuclear holocaust, I think that we had better examine the people that are in leadership.
Yeah.
I mean, that's rather stupid. Mm-hmm.
And where it's moving now, and this is really, I think, where the call to the Christian, the question is, where are you going to put your hope or your security? Because in the arms race, the next move towards the hope of security in the area of arms is space. You know, that if maybe we spend another $1 trillion, we can win for ourselves total security by developing a space warfare system that will stop all of their incoming missiles. And that is the next step. And as each step like that is taken, we have to decide, do we trust this way to finally give us our security, or do we trust another way? Which Jesus said when he wept over Jerusalem because they were trusting one way. He wept and said, would that you knew the way to peace, or the things that make for peace. And with the coming of space warfare, the question again comes, if you want to trust this, you have to go all the way. And those who say that's the way we are going say the problem is that our military budget is too low. If we're going to go that way, we're going to have to raise it and raise it and raise it and raise it, and you know, then, of course, we will have a totally crumbled everything else, but at least.
Well,
in talking about survival, and she said, I don't believe anyone is going to survive. In Washington, D.C., the planners had made plans for different areas to go out to different little towns, and this would be the pod for safety. Mm-hmm. But the little towns hadn't been informed what they're going to do with these hordes of people descending on them. Mm-hmm. So those were the plans that had been made.
It's another sign of hope that more and more people are laughing. You know what I mean? It's this real sign of hope. Yeah. And I think the New Testament is right on when it calls the devil the father of lies. I sometimes say that one of the joys and freedoms of the gospel is to fall over in front of your television set, roll on the floor laughing as commercial after commercial makes its promises. That if anything, the gospel frees us to laugh when certain things say they will give us meaning or security or happiness or final fulfillment. Never forget a perfume ad that promised eternal life. Never forget. And I think that's a sign of hope that more and more people, I mean, there was the one report of the civil defense saying instead of stocking the bomb shelters, we'll send everybody out for McDonald's. You know, this was, I don't know how serious that one was. But.
What's the name of that
perfume? I'm not telling. I have enough just for myself and it's out of production. Every Eucharist, I'll just close saying this. I think every time we celebrate the Eucharist, there's a sign of hope. Because what else do we mean? That Jesus Christ is present in this world.
Well, I'm a Lutheran, but I believe, I don't believe that you have to be so sad at communion. Because I think after communion, you've been forgiven and you should be full of joy.
Yeah, you misunderstood me if I said you should be sad.
The old Lutherans.
Yeah. It's one of the signs of hope, you know, that more Lutherans are smiling at the Eucharist.
When I was at a Heilig convention once when I was in high school, I don't remember the man's name, but he did a little presentation on the Eucharist, the communion, and the solemn attitude that people take and that we should smile. And I'll never forget, he did a communion service for this entire youth gathering, and he played a Snoopy song about being smiling because you were receiving supper, and then he was and he was correlating it to receiving forgiveness, and it was a real different concept to go away and relate this to Snoopy. And I mean, it's got to get you.
Well, that's a good note, since we're sharing the Eucharist tonight, so for Ascension. Yeah.